What's your full name?
My full name is John Larry Flinchpaugh, but I go by Larry because my dad's name was John. So if anybody calls me John, it's usually a bill collector or someone like that. So anyway, I go by Larry, and I was born in the Missouri Methodist Hospital, April 16th, 1939. And I just happened to look at some of my parents' paperwork back in that period. And if I remember correctly, the hospital bill was like $7 a night, and we were in there 2 days. And the medicine was $1.85, something like that. So it's a little bit different today. But actually, I was really involved in my parents' business of animals. My dad started in Kirksville, Missouri. This was back in, 1932. He opened a Plainview Wild Animal Farm and Silver Fox Service Station. And he had animals on display, and he charged an admission to have people come and look at the animals. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was like 10 cents to see the animals. And he always loved animals. But then he came to St. Joe in 1939, just about the time I was born. And he worked for Loose Wiles Biscuit Company, but he still wanted to get back to animals. So he opened a pet shop in 1946 at 603 South 8th Street, 8th and Massaney. And at 8th and Massaney, if you know today, 2017, they torn that whole block down. And it was kind of sad for me to see that torn down because I spent a lot of time there. And I remember right across the street was a Safeway store, and down at the other end of the block was Ben Magoon's, which is, the building is still there. And directly across from Ben Magoon's was a drugstore, and I can't remember the name of the drugstore. But then just south of the drugstore in the next block was Einbender's, and that's behind the police station, the old police station. Not the old police station, but the old police station on 9th Street. Has the big radio tower there. In 1951, my parents bought the Hartsock Hospital at 1202 Frederick. It was a three-story building. We had the pet shop on the main floor, and we lived on the second floor, and the third floor we rented out, and that's where I remember growing up. I worked for Edness Wisniewski at Al's Market directly across the street. And you can just barely still see the Al's Market sign on the old Pepsi sign, particularly if you know what it says. If you don't know what it says, you probably couldn't read it. But anyway, that I have a lot of memories there. And then in 1953, we moved the pet shop to 3727 Frederick, now the location of Citizens Bank and Trust Company. And we called it the Flinchpaugh's Pet Shop, Reptile Gardens and Zoo, and sometimes the Monkey Jungle. And this is where a lot of the fond memories I had. We had a pet chimpanzee called Vicky Lynn, and she was very well known here in St. Joe. She performed at Krug Park about once a year. She was on KFEQ Channel 2, which was called then, instead of KQ. And we had her on TV probably about once a month, something like that. And she would be on the children's show. What was interesting, when I was in high school, I even got a job working at KFEQ TV. And as a teenager in high school, this is probably one of the most interesting jobs I ever had. It was so neat. I remember the first year. We all got a Christmas bonus of $50, and I'd only been working there for about 2 months. I thought that was pretty cool, being in high school and getting a $50 bonus. But my job was called the floor director. And what I would do for the KFEQ, I would cue the announcers how much time they had. I'd put my hand up next to the camera, and I'd hold up two fingers for 2 minutes, and then one for 1 minute to the end of the show. And then when I shook my fist, that meant they were done. They had to stop. So that was really interesting. And I was always an inventive nature, and I remember one time I thought how much fun it would be to make the announcer on the children's program disappear. I was always interested in magic, and Harry had all of these props and cameras and everything, and I thought, surely I can figure out how to do that. So what we did, we had two cameras at that time and live cameramen right there on the floor. So before we went on the air, I had one of the cameramen put his camera on the set that had the animals and everything, but the announcer wasn't in the set, and he turned on the camera and framed it up just perfectly. Then we took a Polaroid shot of the same set and put it on a Polaroid rack with camera two. And it was so simple. When Don Burley, which was the announcer, he said, I'm going to make myself disappear when I say three. And when he said three, we just switched from the live set to the set with him not in it on the Polaroid, and people at home couldn't tell, didn't even see it flip. And people in the office were coming down and saying, wow, how did you do that? And they were looking through the glass window, and he was still there, and they looked in the monitor, and he disappeared. So anyway, I had a lot of fun doing that. That was the kind of thing that it was just exciting to do. And we had one of the funny things, we had wrestling on, some of these stories I can't tell you, but we had wrestling on, I think it was Saturday night, and really live, and we put a mirror on the top of, over the wrestling rink so the camera could shoot up and see straight down the wrestling match. And I remember seeing the wrestlers fighting each other and all mad at each other, and then they'd go off the air, and then both of their families would go out for steak dinner. I mean, it was just, it was all fake, you know. Talk about fake the news today. Well, that was fake sports, but it was, everybody had fun. Let's see, one of the, I lived at 2614 Duncan, which was a block south of Hall School. And Hall was really interesting. When I moved to California in 1976, I told my friends in California that when I was in grade school in St. Joseph, Missouri, we'd go to Bible study class once a week over to Huffman. We'd walk over to Huffman Memorial Church. And they said, you went to a church? That school was mixed in with the church, you know? And they just couldn't believe that. And I said, well, you won't believe this. We went to the Y and swam in the nude. You did what? And people couldn't believe that. And thinking back about it, I still wonder why we did that. The excuse for the Y was it was cleanliness, that didn't have to have a bathing suit to wash or anything. But see, all these naked little boys getting ready to jump in the pool, it was so embarrassing, you know. I still don't know why we did that. I remember the grocery stores close to our house, 2614 Duncan. There was Ballman's Groceries, and I went by it a few years ago, and I must have been in a garage right at the, I guess it was 27th and Duncan. And it's where I learned to gamble. First time I went in there, they had a gumball machine, and they had a few gumballs that were orange or yellow with a red stripe. And you keep putting your pennies in till you got one of those. And if you got one of those, you traded in for a nickel candy bar. So we thought that was pretty neat. And when we didn't have any money, we'd go around and gather up all the soda pop bottles. You get 2 cents a piece. So we'd get three soda pop bottles, and we could get a candy bar and a piece of penny candy or gum. So that was really fun. And then just north of Ballman's was Millard Fisher's grocery store. And up until a couple years ago, it was Dr. Yerth's chiropractic office. I know Marvin Yerth was a chiropractor there, and he was a friend of mine. He died here, three or four years ago. And his brother, I think his, what was his brother's name? Jerry, I believe it was. And I don't believe it's there anymore. I think Jerry may have passed away, too. And then on further towards Jerry Ann's was Deering's Barbershop. Mr. Deering's Barbershop. And then Jerry Ann's cafeteria was on the corner, and across from Jerry Ann's, just to the east, was a Standard Oil service station. And I think they made it into apartments, but you can still see the Standard Oil brickwork and stuff there. We'd take our bikes up there and have them change our tires on our bikes and fix flats when they had a problem with it. Back when I was growing up in the 40s, in the 50s, most families just had one car, And so Dad would take the car to work, and so if Mom and the kids wanted to go to town, we had to ride the bus. And I remember one thing, you don't realize the gifts that you got from your parents. But I remember this was back in the 50s when and we didn't have integration yet, and segregation was in full swing. And we got on the bus, my mother and I got on the bus, and I remember it was real crowded. People had to stand up, but I'd got on early enough, I was able to sit down. Well, an elderly black woman got on the bus, and my mother had me get up, give her my seat. And I can still remember the looks of the people, white people, looking at us, like, what are you doing? And I look back at that, and I think, what a gift. I have trouble even saying this, but what a gift my mother gave me. My whole adult life, I had no problem with integration. I looked at black people just the same as a white people. We all had the same God. Television hadn't been invented yet. Well, it had been. We had television before World War II, but when World War II broke out, that stopped. All the money was going into radar and all this type of thing. But right after World War II, television hit. Everybody was trying to buy a TV, but they were so expensive. It seemed like we bought a Raytheon, a 16-inch Raytheon, and it was $250. Well, you could buy an automobile for $250 then, a used one. And we lived at 12th and Frederick, right close here to the library. And we had a 20-foot antenna on top of the pet shop building and apartment. And all we could get was Channel 4, Kansas City. And it was snowy, it was hard to see. And then we got, I think, Channel 5. And then Channel 9, and oh, we were in heaven. We had three channels. We had ABC, CBS, NBC, and then Channel 2 came on the air. I remember watching them build that huge tower. It's almost 1,000 feet, and we watched them build that huge tower, and it was so interesting. I just couldn't wait till they broadcast, because we'd have another television station. And we got the television station, and it was kind of a duplicate of Kansas City. But we had local news, and some of the programming was on different hours of the day, so it was still nice to have the fourth station. I remember that was way before color television, but you could go to the dime store, and it seemed like it was 69 cents. You got a piece of clear plastic, and the plastic had blue at the top for sky, orange in the middle for faces, and green at the bottom for grass. So if you were watching a baseball game, it looked pretty good. Everything else looked kind of stupid, you know. But you just pushed that, it stuck on the glass. And then if you wanted a bigger screen and didn't want to buy a new television, you bought this huge magnifying glass. It was about 30 inches in diameter on a metal frame. And you'd wheel that up in front of your screen, and the magnifying glass made the picture bigger. The only problem is it made all the snow and imperfections bigger, too. So it really didn't work too well. And right up the street there, it said 13th and Frederick, or at the end of 12th and Frederick, was Midland Empire Sales. The building's just about to fall in. There's one big wall up there now. And people would drive their car up and sit there, and they had a TV set in the window with a speaker outside. And we could watch Ed Sullivan on the sitting in the car. Well, since I only lived a block away, I'd walk up there. And when I'd walk up there, I'd sit on the sidewalk and watch Ed Sullivan. Well, that was really neat. Of course, you know, movies were great, and I still went to the movies after television. Everybody thought the movies would die after television, but we had so many movie theaters here in town. Of course, the Missouri Theater's still here. The Electric Theater is gone, and that was a neat theater. I got to see Gene Autry in person there, and we would go on Saturday, and Pepsi-Cola, I think if you had 15 or 20 bottle caps from Pepsi bottles, you get in free. And we would go to the free movie at 10 o'clock, and we always saw a Western and a cartoon and something like The Three Stooges. And the Westerns were so corny. Every one of them ended the same way. The hero was riding out of town with his horse, and the young lady that he had helped, and his her father owned the ranch, they would wave, "Can't you stay?" "No, I've got to move on." And they all were the same. So, but it was still fun. And there were so many theaters here. The Orpheum Theater, I only went to once or twice. And I look at the old pictures of the Orpheum Theater, and oh, what a shame that that was taken down. I mean, that was a work of art. And it was a beautiful theater. And then there was another one called the Joe, and I can't remember for sure where the Joe was. It was like on 3rd Street or something like that. Then we had the Hickory Theater. Come to find out later, the Hickory Theater was owned by a friend of mine, John Eli. And let's see, and then there was the Uptown Theater. There's a construction company there now, 22nd and Frederick. And there was several others. I think the Rialto was up north of St. Joe. And in the south, it seems like there was the Kent and the Regal or something. I get the Regal and Rialto mixed up. But anyway, we had quite a few theaters. And we had two drive-ins. Well, we had three. Let's see, the Belt, the Skylark, and the Cowtown. The Cowtown was kind of hard to go to because there's a lot of mosquitoes down there. So we didn't have air conditioning in the car, so you couldn't roll the windows up. So yeah, we didn't go there very often. But the Skylark and the Belt was a lot of fun. And the drive-in theaters, when they first started, I understand that the big movie companies only gave them grade B movies because they didn't want the competition with the Missouri Theater and Electric, things like that. And but the drive-in was really neat because you didn't have to hire a babysitter, you didn't have to find a place to park, you didn't have to get dressed up. The parking was included in the price of admission, and it was a great place to take a date for dinner and a movie. Of course, when I was in high school, I always went to the drive-in theater to a movie I'd already seen with my date, so I didn't have to bother watching the movie. And some of the drive-ins, they would even change flat tires, wash your clothes, you could take your laundry in. I don't believe they did that at the Bell. I love to go to Ben Magoon's on South 8th Street and buy the pastrami sandwiches. We'd get pastrami sandwiches on pumpernickel bread and potato salad and then head for the drive-in with my date. That was fun. I get tickled at people today don't even know what pumpernickel bread is. Their idea of pumpernickel bread is white bread with caramel coloring and sprinkle some seeds on it. That's not pumpernickel. Anyway, I'd like to know where I can get good pumpernickel, but I haven't found it. Then Wade's Indian Grill was on 22nd Street as I first remember, and then they across from the Uptown Theater, and then they moved over on Mitchell Avenue, and that was such a neat place to go. They were open late at night. And I know when my dad would go with me and my mother, my dad would get a brain sandwich. It about made me sick to watch him eat it. But my dad ate brain sandwiches and pig's feet, pig knuckles, all these kind of things. Some of the great movies that I watched, the heroes, of course, was Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, and Johnny Mac Brown and Lash LaRue. I remember Johnny Mac Brown was one of my favorites for some reason. And I saw a movie on television here a few years ago, and I heard this voice, and it sounded so familiar. But the guy was real old, you know. So I got on Google and looked it up, and it was Johnny Mac Brown. It's fun to watch the movies and see the old characters that you idolized. Abbott and Costello was good, The Three Stooges, Laurel and Hardy. Oh, the Bowery Boys was my favorite. They had Leo Gorcey and Hunts Hall, and they drove an old Model T, and they were always getting in trouble. But it was really neat. It really bothered me, like I said earlier, about integration and segregation in the 1950s. I couldn't believe why we had to have the government get involved, because I thought all of the good Christians would take care of it on their own, but they didn't. And this bothered me about, there was something wrong here with religion. I kept thinking, do the whites think the blacks have a different God? I mean, this is ridiculous. And I guess that's probably why I'm pretty critical of religion today. I'm really, I call myself a deist, And I usually tell people that, so they don't know what that is, so it gives me time to get away while they look it up. When I was in high school, one of my teachers was Liesl Carroll at Central, and he was a ham radio operator, and I always was interested in electronics. And my grandmother had given me a shortwave radio that had shortwave on it, probably in the late 40s, and I kept hearing this on there, and I wondered what that was. And somebody said, "Well, that's Morse code. And if you knew how to read that, you could write it down." And I thought, "Oh, that would really be cool to be like a secret message, you know." So I tried to learn it. I was in Boy Scouts, and I tried to learn it, and it was terrible. I couldn't learn it. And so then I found out there was a ham radio club here, and there was a man named Milt Hansen. I think he worked for Western Union. And he said, "If you'll come over to my house, I've got a group, and we're teaching you the Morse code so you can get a ham radio license." And I thought, boy, that'll be nice. And for the first time, I had somebody show me how to learn. He started us out learning EISH. And it was real simple. E was dit, I was dit, dit, S was dit, 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 and H was dit, 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 and 5 was 5 dits. I thought, well, I can remember that. And then TMO, T was da, M was da, da, and O was da, da, da. So now I had EISH, TMO, then we learned A, did da, and N was the opposite, da, dit. Well, by using this method, it was just a short time I learned how to read Morse code. And it was so neat, I passed my ham license, and I had to go to Kansas City. Today, we do it locally. The local hams are authorized to do the test for the government. But anyway, I had to go to the federal building in Kansas City, and I was up on about the 13th or 14th floor, and I was scared to death. And they sent out the Morse code, and I had to get it 100% for like 25 characters or something like that, and I passed it. And then they ask us the questions, electronic questions and rules, you know, how much power you could run, that type of thing. And so I was able to pass that. I came home and got on the air and started, we called a CQ, da-da-da-dit, da-da-da-da, and then DE, this is, da-da-dit-dit, your call letters. And some guy answered me, and it was in an airplane. Now remember, I'm in high school. And I'm here at 12th and Frederick. I've got a little antenna up on my building, and I built a small transmitter, soldered it all together and everything. And this guy answered me from an airplane, and I guess it was a mail plane. I think it was a DC-3. And I only talked to him for about 45 minutes, but he was just leaving Missouri when I talked to him, and he went into Illinois, Ohio, and was entering Indiana. And he sent me a card with the airplane's picture on it and everything. I was so excited. And I lost that card. I don't know where it is. But anyway, that was how much fun you could have with that. And then the next license would allow you to talk with a microphone. So I studied, and John Graham and Marvin Yerth and myself and I, we studied. We had to memorize it. We didn't know. It was like Polly won a cracker. We didn't know what a cracker, Polly doesn't know what a cracker is. We just memorized everything. Like your driver's test. And we memorized it, and all three of us passed. And then we would we joined the ham radio club, and we had so much fun. One of our most fun things was to have a radio hunt, and we'd meet at the Nighthawk restaurant there at 22nd and Frederick, and we'd all chip in 50 cents. And then we had an antenna with a loop on it, and one guy we'd give him 20 minutes, and he'd go hide somewhere in town. And then we would talk, as he talked to us, we would aim our antennas, and we'd say, okay, it's this direction. But the problem was we didn't know whether it was that direction or directly behind. We had to drive about a half a mile to see if it got stronger or weaker, and then if it got weaker, we knew we'd made a mistake. But anyway, it was really fun, and we'd go find the guy. And when we'd find whoever found him first got the pot, which was usually $4 or $5, you know. And one night, Bob Shellhorn had his car and radio, and we wanted to really make it hard for him to find us. So we drove out Waterworks Road, and you know where the gambling thing is there? There's a railroad bridge, and we drove down under the railroad bridge, and we weren't on the tracks, but just next to it in the brush, and we took a hatchet, and we chopped down a bunch of twigs and covered up the whole car. And all the thing was sticking out was the antenna up through all these bushes. They'd like to never found us. They didn't think that was fair, but one guy did find. We saw him with a flashlight coming through the brush. So that was kind of things we did. Getting back to my father in the animal business, back in Kirksville, Missouri, when he started in the 30s, he made friends with Miller Brothers Circus. It was Al G. K. Miller Brothers Circus, and today it's called Carson and Barnes Circus. In fact, Carson and Barnes Circus came here, St. Joe, about 2 years ago, and I went out and visited with the family, and it's all the grandkids. They barely remembered my father working with their grandfather or great-grandfather. But anyway, anytime a circus would come anywhere near St. Joe, my dad would always go to it because he wanted to see his old friends. And we'd go up 100 miles to see the circus. One of them that came to St. Joe was Coal Brothers Railroad Show. And I remember the Coal Brothers was down, I think it was on 5th and Atchison, where they had the circus grounds. And we went down and we got on the railroad cars, and I couldn't believe it. There were slot machines, roulette machines, and the owner wanted to talk to my dad, so he just gave me a whole handful of nickels. Now, I think I was in junior high school. So while they were talking, I played slot machines, you know, and I looked out the window, there were policemen walking up and down guarding the train, you know. I don't know what they had to pay them to disguard for, keep all the riffraff out. Next day I went to school and told everybody I went played the slot machines last night. Nobody would believe me, and I couldn't prove it. One of the most exciting things that happened at the reptile gardens was in August 1959. We had rattlesnakes, copperheads, all kinds of snakes, and we also had a cobra. We had a king cobra, and we also had the smaller Indian cobras. And I remember even at the time, I hated the fact that we had to have cobras. I mean, you know, you can survive a rattlesnake bite, but a cobra bite, you die in about 10 minutes. So we always worried about that. And like I said, it was August 1959. There was 20 or 30 people touring the reptile gardens. And all of a sudden, my dad came running up to the front ticket office and whispered, "Bill White, our snake handler's just gotten bitten by the cobra." And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? And my dad, as he went out the door to take Bill to the hospital, he said, "The snake has got to be put back in the cage." And I'm just a teenager. I don't like snakes. And I definitely don't like cobras that can kill you. So I ran back to the back rooms, just trembling. And there was a bunch of people there. And I said, "Everybody, please get out of the building. We got a black snake loose." Well, it was a black cobra, but I just left off the cobra part. And here on the floor was a big sack with a stick, like a butterfly net. And what we would do is we'd put the cobra in that sack and then twist it and put it on the floor and clean their cage and then put it back, let it dump it out of the sack. What had happened, Bill had grabbed the sack and the cobra bit him through the sack. And I thought, oh no, and is the cobra in the sack or under the sack? So I had a snake hook that was like a golf club with a hook on it. So I lifted the sack up really, and cobras are slow, so I could have kept him away from me with that stick. But I raised it up, and he wasn't under the sack, so I knew he was in the sack. So I picked up the sack with a stick real carefully and kept it twisted and opened the cobra door, threw the sack and all inside, shut the door and locked it. So I thought, you know, I should try to get him an escort to the hospital. I had no idea how long that had been between him going out and me putting the snake away. So I got on the telephone, and I tried to call the police department, and I was in a state of shock. And you like to think you have control, but your body shuts down. And all I could say was, "Reptile garden, snake bite, escort, hospital." That's all I could say. And so I hung up, and I got in our company truck, and I went over to Bill White's house to get his wife. I thought I should take his wife to the hospital. And when I knocked on the door, she came to the door and just looked at me. And I hadn't said a word. She said, "Did Bill get bitten by the cobra?" Oh my God, I must have been white as a sheet, you know. So anyway, I said yes. And she didn't say a word, and we got in the car, and we're going down Frederick, and a motorcycle siren comes up, "Follow me." I said, "No, we're just going to the hospital." So we got to the hospital, and Dr. Dumont was off that. It was on a Sunday, and Dr. Dumont wasn't working that day, and they called him. He says, "I don't know what to do." He says, "We don't have Cobras in Missouri." And my dad said, "Well, Bill Haas in Miami Serpentarium's expert on this. In fact, he has some anti-venom that might work." And Dr. Dumont told the nurse to call Bill Haas. She said, the telephone operator said, "All the lines are busy." Dr. Dumont grabbed the phone and he said, "This is Dr. Dumont. This is a matter of life and death." And hello, and we had him. And my dad and the doctor had explained, my dad knew Bill Haas anyway because they had visited years ago. And Bill Haas said, let me have a couple minutes. In about 5 minutes, he came back on the line and he said, "I just called Homestead Air Force Base, which is about 10 miles from here or so." And he said, "They were on a trip to Ohio and they're going to leave right now and they're sending a helicopter over to get the antivenom, and we'll have it there in 4 hours. So we thought, well, we'll at least get the antivenom. We're doing everything we possibly can. So I don't know how this happened, but I found myself in the back seat of the police car at Rosecrans Field, which was a big mistake because I didn't need to do this. I still don't remember how that happened. But we're in Rosecrans Field, and by that time, the photographers and cameras and all these people are there. And we hear on the radio, they have the tower radio on a speaker, and the jet's over Kansas City. And like a minute later, he's over St. Joe. And they usually come in on an angle. He just flew right straight down. And I can still remember when they landed, the cockpit opened, the cameras were flashing, and the policeman's up here grabbing the little box of serum. They were getting the police car, and we head for Highway 36 to come across the bridge. We got over to Highway 36, and the Highway Patrol had, the traffic was backed up for miles. And it was just straight shot, right straight down the Pony Express Bridge. And I can't remember if it was 8th Street or 9th Street. It might have been 9th Street. And I looked at I was in the back seat, and I looked at the speedometer. It was like 55 miles an hour. Can you imagine going 55 down 9th Street? And the cop had a hold of the steering wheel, and he's pumping it back and forth, looking left, looking right. And the buildings are going, you know, just, I thought, oh my God, I don't need to be here. And we got to the hospital, and he didn't even take the elevator. He jumps out and runs up the steps and gives the Dr. Dumont the medicine. And they gave him a shot. And Dr. Dumont had an iron lung ready in case Bill's lungs collapsed, which they didn't. And we got the medicine, and about 3 hours later, Dr. Dumont says, "You know, I think he's going to make it." So we were all relieved. And it was really interesting. Over my lifetime, I've been involved in other news stories that I knew something about, and they were so screwed up. You know, they got the names wrong, the time was wrong. This was perfect. And I think part of it was because the news press and me was in the car, and we were giving them all the real information. You know, it wasn't secondhand. And I was going home at midnight from the hospital, and I just turned on the AM radio, and every place I tuned was St. Joseph, Missouri. Heroic. I can't even hardly talk about this. Heroic flight saves snake bite victim. We had friends in France and different places in the world, and this made the news everywhere. It's emotional to talk about it. It's interesting to notice the difference in prices. I don't think I told you the one live yet about the gas, but it was always interesting to me as I got older to study our banking system and all, is what's happened to prices. In the 1950s, I remember gasoline being 25 cents a gallon, and a dollar, paper dollar, would buy 4 gallons, and a silver dollar would be four gallons. But what happened later, like today, gasoline was $2.09 or plus, which a dollar won't even buy 1 gallon. But if silver dollars were $16 or $17, it'll buy what, eight gallons. So that tells you that something's wrong with our monetary system. I've written a few books on that, but this is one of the big things that happened in my life. Is when I retired, I started researching all of this, and I wanted to find out why. And another thing I wanted to find out is what I believed about my religion. My mother was a good Christian lady that went to Westminster Presbyterian Church. And as I got older, I went through a period where I didn't believe what they were saying. I didn't believe in the Trinity concept, which meant I couldn't truly be a Christian. And then I left that and went back to where I did believe it. And then I went back again, and I just vacillated between it. And I finally ended up being a deist, which a lot of our founding fathers were deists. And that just means they believe in a God, a creator, but that God or creator doesn't normally interfere in our lives. Well, that's pretty simple, you know. Yeah, I wish I'd have kept that a secret, because I know that hurt my mother. Okay, do you have any questions that you want to ask me?
Did your father get into animals? Where did that come from?
Well, when he started, he hunted for pelts, for furs. And one of his best friends, an adult friend, had a fur company. And when my dad was growing up, he would walk the creeks and shoot muskrats and possums and raccoons, and they made hats, you know, out of the raccoons and all that. And he was taught how to be a fur grader. They would buy from all these farmers and people that shot animals, and he would say, well, this is grade A, grade B, whatever. And he really got good at it. But then when he got older, he felt so bad about killing all those animals, and he wanted to have some way to take care of them. And so that got him into the animal business. And then when he got in with friends with the Miller Brothers Circus, and they sold animals back and forth, it was really nice, because when we had the reptile gardens here, he would call Miller Brothers. It was Obert Miller. See, it was Obert and Dory and Kelly. I can't believe I remember their names. They're headquartered in Hugo, Oklahoma. But he would call them and say he'd like to have an African lion. So we'd get this little cub African lion, and I thought, oh boy, I've got a chimpanzee. That's every kid's dream. Now I got a pet lion a pet. And I thought, I'm going to train this lion just like they do in the movies. Wrong. It's not that simple. We'd get these little lions, and we'd put a collar on them, and every time I'd try to put a chain on the collar, the lion would go, snarl at me, you know. And I'd finally get it on it, and I'd try to walk him down the aisle, and he'd want to walk this way, and I'd want to walk this way. And when he got up to about the size of a German Shepherd, it was getting kind of dangerous. And the only way I could take him for a walk then, because he'd turn around and take his paw and try to knock me off my feet. And his paws were huge. And so I took a piece of pipe, and I ran the chain of the leash down through the pipe. Then I'd put the pipe up next to his collar, and then I could hold it so he couldn't get close to me. And I finally decided, this isn't fun at all, you know. I mean, it's kind of scary, in fact. So we got another lion a couple years later, and we thought, well, this one we will not give it any red meat. We'll just feed it dry dog food. That didn't work. Same thing. So I finally decided the only way you're going to do this is get these lions before their eyes open. And the first thing they see is a human being instead of another big lion. And then they will, what do they call it?
Imprinting
with you, you know. So that never happened. But even Vicky the chimp, it was so scary when she got older. When she was little, she was pretty friendly. A lot of funny things would happen. I remember one day a lady came in to get a Coke, and she was trying to put her dime in the Coke machine. And the instructions were right on the Coke machine: deposit dime, pull down handle, open door, remove bottle. She would put her dime in and pull the handle before it. You know, she says, I can't get this machine to work. I said, give me your dime. So I had Vicky out. I gave Vicky the dime. And I said, Vicky, get the lady a Coke. And so Vicky puts the dime in her mouth so it's horizontal to go in the slot. She drops it in the slot. She pulls the handle down, opens the door, pulls the bottle out. I looked at the lady and I said, see, anybody can do it. The lady didn't think it was funny. And Vicky didn't think it was funny either because she assumed the Coke was for her, not the lady. So I said, okay, Vicky, you keep the Coke. I'll get the lady another one. So then I got the lady a Coke. And I remember we had a kitchen at the Reptile Gardens, and in the morning before we would open, my mother a lot of times would cook breakfast for us or something, and she had just taken a cake out of the oven. It was a white cake with frosting, coconut frosting, and I was in the back, and I heard the kitchen door slam and my mother scream, and I come running to the front, and here's Vicky running out of the kitchen with this chocolate or vanilla icing and coconut cake under one arm with stickiness all over her black fur, and she's picking it and eating it as she's going. And they laughed. If I'd have done that when I was her age, I'd have been put to bed, you know. And it was amazing. She, we had a Volkswagen, I can't remember what year it was, we had a Volkswagen car, and Vicky liked to ride. I'd put her in the back seat of the car, and we'd come up to like the Belt Highway there in Frederick, and there'd be a car in the next lane, and they'd look over, and some of them would even not even pay any. Some of them would look, then they'd turn back and look again. What in the world is that? It's not a dog. But we got to the post office, and we had a post office box there, and so Phyllis was my girlfriend then. She went in to get the, or I went in to get the mail. And I said, now you hold on to Vicky's chain here. She won't bother you. But I said, just in case, here's my blank pistol. I had a pistol with blanks in it. Well, while I was gone, Phyllis dropped the pistol down between the seats. Vicky reached down with her thin hand, reached down, picked up the pistol, and handed it to Phyllis. Phyllis thought, oh my gosh, she's going to shoot me. But Vicky at that time didn't know what the pistol was. So it was a few months later, I was putting Vicky back in her cage, and it had two locks on it, and when I got one lock in, she threw a fit, which I think that is common for chimpanzees. They go through like an adolescent period of humans. She reached out of the bars to grab me. She's screaming, her teeth are chattering, trying to bite me, and my arm was perpendicular to the bar, so she couldn't get it in there. And I couldn't reach the pistol because it was in the opposite side of my pocket. But I finally twisted around and got the pistol and shoved it into her stomach while she's screaming and trying to bite me. I shot six times before she let me go, and it shot fire out of the pistol, blanks, you know, burned all the hair off of her stomach. And I said, that's it, I'm done. I won't take her out anymore. And it was real, so sad because she was one of the family, you know. And I used to try to give her tests to see how smart she was. And we kept the padlock key on a nail that was just outside of the reach where she couldn't reach it. So one day I said, I'm going to see how smart she is. So I gave her a yardstick. And she's playing with the yardstick, and then all of a sudden she thinks, and she looks up there at that key on the nail, and she takes the yardstick out, and she flips it, and the keys fall to the floor. She takes the yardstick and drags the keys over, reaches out, gets the keys, puts them in the lock, but she didn't understand that it had the dexterity to turn it to open the lock, but she had the right idea. It was amazing. I tried to, you know, to see if she was colorblind, and I did test on her, and I never did come to a conclusion whether it was color or the shape. But and another thing, after I got older, I kept seeing where they taught chimpanzees and gorillas to use sign language, and I thought, oh, why didn't I work on that? That would I didn't even know it at the time. Anyway, I contacted Dr. Roger Fouts, I think, at Oklahoma University, I believe it was, and he sent me a whole stack of research papers on it. And if I'd have known what he was teaching me, I could have taught her to speak in sign language, and then I could have asked her if she believed in evolution. I thought, boy, that would have really been great, you know. But she was just amazing, her intelligence. I think the chimpanzees have the intelligence of a 5 or 6 year old or something like that. Do you have any other questions?
Well, kind of just about the animals and the pet store for now. Kind of throughout the progression of you move different pet stores, what kind of animals did you have?
Well, we even had the lion at 603 South 8th Street. And I was young then, and I didn't mess with the lion then, and the one we got was a little too big. It's the pictures in my book, Growing Up in a Zoo. So I didn't mess with that one too much. But we had cinnamon ringtail monkeys. We had the African lion, and we always had dogs and cats. I remember one time there were some cats in the window, and a lady came in, and she wanted to sell us one of her puppies. And my dad said, how much you want for the puppy? She said, $50. And my dad said, well, he said, I couldn't pay you $50 for your puppy, but I'll trade you those two $25 cats in the window. And I was just a young kid, and I thought that was so funny. And the lady didn't get it. You know, the cats were worth about $1.50 a piece, you know. But it was funny. My dad had a good sense of humor. And then when we were on Frederick, we had monkeys in the window. I remember Bill Lowe was a paper boy. I went to high school with him. But in junior high school, he would walk by at 3 a.m. and tap on the window, wake up the monkeys. He told me that later. And we had fish and bird. We had called a bird hotel, and we had all the birds there. And then we had a lot of tropical fish. And we had a meat case. We sold fresh horse meat for people to buy for their dogs. And I don't think any, you know, you couldn't buy horse meat in a grocery store like that. So we had quite a bit there. And then when we got the reptile gardens, originally the reptile gardens was called Pony Express Reptile Gardens. And it was owned by Nick Nickerson. It had Nickerson Appliance on the end of King Hill. And he had hired my dad to work to manage it for about a year. And then Nick wanted to open one in Bagnell Dam in South Missouri, and so my dad bought the property there. And I remember, you know, today, that was quite a bit of money for my dad. I think they had to pay $25,000 for the property. And my dad called Charlie Schaft at the Park Bank here in St. Joe. And Charlie came out and went through everything. About 2 o'clock that afternoon, he called back and said, well, you got the loan. And if that had been today, they'd had it approved in New York City on the 14th floor, and they'd had a point system, you know, and all that stuff. But anyway, we bought it for like $25,000. And then, I forget, in the 60s, the Citizens Bank and Loan, which is there now, wanted to buy it. And I think they paid something like $60-some thousand dollars. And we were so excited. We tripled our money in just a few short years. If we'd have kept that now, it would have probably been worth a couple million dollars, you know. But anyway, then my father went up to Muscatine, Iowa to manage the Weed Park Zoo, and he took Vicky with him, and that's where she died. I think she was about 18 years old when she died. She could have lived longer, but they're real susceptible to pneumonia and diseases that humans get. But then my dad came back here to finally retire. So lots of animal stories. I'm probably forgetting a few, but it was, at the time, I didn't really realize what a wonderful opportunity I had with all these animals. I mean, my children and my grandchildren look at this, they say, boy, oh boy, what a life to have your own chimpanzee, you know. It was so neat. I took Vicky to Central High School one day, and they had a big auditorium there, you know, and we had some program, and I forget what it was, and the first prize was to get a kiss from the most beautiful girl in the school. Well, whoever won the prize, I brought out Vicky, and Vicky kissed him. It was so funny, you know. But she was amazing. And I was in the Apple Blossom Parade with the monkey on the cover of my book, Growing Up in a Zoo. And I can't remember what year that was, probably about 1948. And the monkey wanted to ride on my shoulder, and we were just starting the parade, and the monkey had to go to the bathroom. and it did both of them. And for the next 45 minutes, me walking into parade, all this stuff's running down my back, and I had to walk the whole distance, you know. Oh, then I remember Kitty LaClover potato chips wanted me to came into my dad's pet shop here at 12th and Frederick, and they had a show on Channel 4 in Kansas City where kids would bring in their pets, and they want to know if I could bring a pet. My dad said, well, yeah, Cuda Monday. He says, and if you win, you'll get a new bicycle. And my dad said, well, we'll do it, but we got to make sure we're going to win. And the guy looked at him and says, okay, you'll win. So I took the Cuda Monday to, and Cuda Monday looks like a raccoon, except it's got a good set of teeth. Well, raccoons do too. And I think they just got in color television. I'm not sure. But I said, Dad, what if the Cuda Monday bites me? And my dad said, well, just put your hand in your pocket. But anyway, I got on there, and I won the bicycle. Real nice swim bicycle, so it was really nice. We had a lot of fun, and going to the circuses was great because we knew the people, and they would put us on the bandstand. Miller Brothers was a three-ring circus, and they in the center of the tent on the edge was the bandstand where the elephants and the circus troops would come through, and we'd set us a chair right up next to the trombone players and all, you know. And in fact, when Carson and Barnes came here in St. Joe about 4 years ago, I just happened to have a hat of the old circus people, and I said, I was just wondering, anybody will notice that? So I put that hat on, and we walked out there. These people kept looking at us, and somebody came over, where'd you get that hat? And I told them who I was, and they said, oh, just a minute. So they went and got the owner and brought him up there. I said, yeah, I remember your dad, Johnny Flinchpaw, from St. Joe. Says, they still talk about him. And they said, come on, we'll get you a good place. And they brought us into the big tent there here in St. Joe and got us right up the center of the tent. Really nice place. It was fun to do. And then one time we went over to Cameron, and I'd already been to one of the circuses when they asked for a kid volunteer, and I missed it. But this time I was ready. When I ran out there, this clown put a belt on me with a rope on it, put me up on a horse, and then the horse would run around a circle, and then when I'd fall off, they'd just pull on the rope, and I'd be dangling up in the air, you know. And they did the same thing for my sister. My sister's 9 years older than I am, and they dressed her up in a real fancy costume, and she rode up on the elephant's head, and as they made a parade in the circus tent in the beginning, and she did that. She thought that was really exciting. My mom and dad, before the animal farm, they worked during the Depression. They worked with circuses and carnivals. They called them carnies and circies. And my mother made cotton candy, and my dad took care of the lions and fed them and all. And if I remember right, my mother wanted to keep that part of her life a secret. I don't think she was too proud of that. She had a little more class than making cotton candy on a circus. A lot of interesting experiences. You just don't realize till you get older, you know, how fortunate you've been through your life. And I moved to California in 1976 from Oklahoma. I worked for Phillips Petroleum Company and got a job with Tosco in California, the oil and shale corporation. And when I was out there, I never thought about getting in the animal business because I'd had enough of that. We didn't make hardly any money except on the real estate. And I kind of learned from my dad that there's probably more money to be made on real estate than there is your business. So I encourage anybody that it's in business, mix in real estate with it. Don't rent from somebody. Buy the building or buy the lot or buy the farm, whatever it is. So, you know, you learn these things from your parents. Any other questions?
I was kind of curious. I noticed when I looked through your book and the different pet stores that you had, and you kind of moved eastward. Was there a reason for that? Were you kind of...
It was mainly opportunity. That building on Frederick became available. We always wanted a pet shop downtown because, you know, in the 40s and 50s and even the 60s, the downtown was the place to be, but it was very expensive. And come to find out what I know now, the reason why it was expensive, because it was worth it. That's where the customers were. So, but we hadn't progressed to that level yet. So anyway, the building on 8th and on 12th and Frederick came available, and we sold our house on Duncan to help pay for that. And then we rented the apartment out, which meant we had revenue coming from that.
When you moved out, kind of where East Hills is now, what was out there?
Oh, across the street was a cornfield where the shopping center is. It was owned by Farber, a man named Farber. And behind the pet shop and the reptile garden was an airport. And that was exciting, because I was learning to fly while I was in high school. Liesl Carroll, my algebra teacher at Central, was learning to get his pilot's teaching permit. And so he said he would teach me to fly, but he didn't have the credentials yet, so we couldn't log it. But he said, you pay for the gas and oil, and I'll teach you to fly. And that was so much fun. We'd go out to Rosecrans Field, and we'd fly in a Cessna. The first plane was an Aeronica Chief and an Aeronica Champ, and I think that had a stick. Then the Aeronica, the Aeronica Chief, the Aeronica Champ, and then one of them had a wheel, like a car. And then we got a Cessna 120 and a Cessna 140. I never did make it to the 150. That was a really expensive plane. But the Aeronica Chief and Champ, they were so simple. I mean, they didn't have a starter. The way we would start the plane, Liesl would put his feet on the brakes, and I would put my hand on the propeller. And you didn't want to cup your thumbs under here, because if it started, you might cut your arms off. So you put the palm of your hands and you put one foot forward, so when you come down, you automatically go backwards like that. And I wouldn't do that today. That's like starting your lawnmower by turning it upside down and turning the blade, you know. I can't believe I did that. But then we would fly, and we would fly for about an hour, and he'd say, okay, head back to the airport. And I'd look down, okay, where's the airport? And we'd finally line up at the airport, and it's about the size of a postage stamp when you're 1,000 feet. And the runway is about an inch long. And here you are, you're going to have to line this up and decrease your altitude, you know. I remember we always did what they call stall landings. We'd get about a foot off the ground, you just keep pulling the stick back where the plane couldn't fly anymore, and it just dropped. Well, it's okay to drop a foot, because that's what you're supposed to do. Well, we were at 2,000 feet one time, and he was going to do a stall at 2,000 feet. So he told me to pull back on the stick, pull back on the stick, and I kept doing that. And finally, the plane just went straight forward, and then it gained speed, and you level off again. Well, it's okay to stall at 2,000 feet and drop 700 or 800 feet, but you can't drop 700 or 800 feet when you're 100 foot off the ground. You know, you're going to die. And when you're flying like that, there's no trees going by or anything, so you have no feeling what's happening. And I remember he told me to do a 360, and I wasn't sure what a 360 was. I finally decided he wanted me to make a turn and end up where I started from. See? So I tilted the plane over to make the turn, and he taps me on the shoulder. I said, what's the matter? He says, do you have any strange feeling? And I said, no. He said, look at the altimeter. And we'd started out 2,000, 1,800, 17, 16, 15, 14. He said, we can't do this very long. I had no idea that I was falling. So I learned that when you do that, you skid around and you increase your RPM, but you just kind of skid around, you know. And but it was exciting. And I remember one time, I was up with him, and I didn't do this. This was a friend of mine did this. I may have lied in my book. I might have said it was me. But anyway, when you're an author, you can screw up the facts a little bit. But I couldn't get back to St. Joe. So what we did was we flew down over the water tower and saw Platte City on the water tower. And I had a road map, and I took Highway 36 and followed back up from Platte City up to St. Joe to the airport. I could have done that. I'm not sure I really did that, but I could have done that. One time he told me to make a landing, and I said, there's no airport here. And he said, well, What if you had to make a landing? So I started circling and losing altitude and circling and circling. Got down close, got over a cornfield. I, God, he surely is not going to have me land in this cornfield. And there's some kids in a, on the highway driving next to the cornfield waving at us as we're going, you know. And I get right down on top of the corn. He says, okay, take it back up. So yeah, it was exciting. And I didn't keep this up. After I got older, it was just way too expensive. And even today, most people, you've got to be fairly wealthy to have an airplane. And if you, even doctors and lawyers go together in a club, and the five doctors or five CPAs or lawyers will buy one plane, and then the odds of them all wanting at the same time is not very much, you know. So that's how they do it today.
But there wasn't much development out.
Well, the airport, the little airport was behind us, mm-hmm. and I remember Oscar Cook that had Cook Implements. He had a Piper Apache, twin engine Piper Apache, and he was up there one day, and I said, boy, I'd sure like to fly in that twin engine plane. He said, well, go ask your mother and dad. He says, I'm going over to a farm I have over here by Elwood, check my corn crop. And so anyway, they said, okay. And thinking back, was somebody in a twin-engine plane like that, and if something had happened to him and me in a twin-engine plane, I wouldn't have had a clue how to get it down. My company plane had a similar situation, but we had a turboprop King Air in the company I worked for, Tosco in California, and it was coming to pick me up in Los Angeles. And got word that our company plane had crashed. They couldn't pick me up. Like, oh, my goodness. Come to find out later, only one wheel would come down. But they had a co-pilot. So I learned from later that the pilots made an agreement. One of them says, I'll operate the engines and you operate the trimming, you know, the plane. Because with one engine, it was going to make the plane curve to the left or something. Well, you could trim it out where you, but it took a lot of maneuvering and ability to operate the RPM of the engine and trim the ailerons and the rudder and everything to offset that pull. And they got down, only did about $300,000 or $400,000 worth of damage to the plane, but everybody walked away from it. So that kind of made me a believer that if you're in a twin engine plane, I want two pilots. I mean, it's a good safety feature, you know.
Well, that's all I have for you today, unless there's anything else that you want to talk about real quick that we didn't touch on.
Oh, I could talk for hours.
Well, and we can always do another interview.
Now that I'm retired, that's all I can do. You can see I've got 7 books on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the Zoo book. I've got another one called Secrets of Our Hidden Controllers Revealed, which is mm-hmm. kind of a depressing book. I wrote the Zoo book first, mm-hmm. so I'd make it look like I was normal. Then I came up with it. Then I wrote a novel. It's called a historical novel, Against All Odds, President Paul Ronan. Mm-hmm. And this starts out in 1848 in Ireland. And in 4 generations, the first one comes over in 1848, and in 4 generations, they become, the great-great-grandson becomes President of the United States. Anyway, splice it in, maybe.
That's
fine. I was playing catch with Vicky. At the Reptile Gardens, she was on a stool, and I had a desk probably 10 feet away that had a whole pile of grapes on it that we're getting ready to feed the monkeys. And Vicky's throwing the ball back and forth, and she's looking over at those grapes. And I said, don't you get off the stool, because I knew she wanted her grapes. And she kept looking at them and just kept throwing the ball back and forth. And then she stopped, and you could see her thinking. She took the ball and threw it clear away from that desk down the hallway. I had to go chase the ball, and I knew what she was up to, but I wanted to reward her for being so smart. So I ran down and I got the ball. When I came back, she was still on the stool, but I looked over and all the grapes were gone, and there was juice and grapes just oozing out of her mouth, dripping down, like I wouldn't know, you know. I mean, isn't that intelligent?
She's fast, too.
It's just unbelievable. That's probably it.